In Victorian England, the press were never shy of calling a crime the sensation of the century, or a murder the most astonishing the world has ever seen. When the body of a young woman showed up on the beach of a popular seaside resort town, no one would have imagined that it would provoke just such proclamations. As the story unravelled, and the winding and at times explosive court case drew on, however, it became clear that not only would it provoke such headlines, but it would also be entirely worthy of many of them. This is Dark Histories, where the facts are worse than fiction. Hello, welcome to Dark Histories, Season 8, Episode 6. I'm the host, Ben. Today we're going to be going back to the Victorian times, as, you know, quite common in these parts, but we're going back to the very, very edge of the Victorian, so the turn of the 20th century, 1900, and we're going to be able to look at a sort of true crime mystery kind of affair. So let's just jump straight into it, because I don't think I have much news to speak of, so let's just go straight into it. This episode is called The Mysterious Murder of Mary Jane Bennett. On the far eastern coast of England, 130 miles northeast of London, the coastal town of Great Yarmouth, with its long, sandy beaches, has long been a getaway resort for people from the capital and across the country. A relatively bustling medieval fishing and shipbuilding port, the town saw renewed growth in the late 18th century when the fashionable trend for visiting seaside resorts exploded, and this continued throughout the 19th century, especially after the country's rail infrastructure expanded to the town in 1844. By the turn of the century, the town had grown from a North Sea fishing port primarily focused on an economy of herring and mackerel to a bustling tourist resort. Two piers were built in the 1850s, the Wellington and the Britannia stretched out across the deep sandy beaches, whilst hotels, guest houses, sea water baths and public gardens sprung up along the promenade. Visitors were able to rent a bathing machine from Whitney Capps, an enterprising local with an empire of family-sized machines that he charged out to visitors at 3 pence per day. The large wooden sheds on 4-foot-tall cartwheels had a secondary purpose, and they acted like giant billboards, with Capps advertising swimming lessons for the whole family in large painted letters on the side, along with Beecham's Pills, a laxative that was touted as a cure-all, able to remove disease, stir up the liver and promote good health. For the stream of tourists walking back to their lodgings after a day at the beach, shellfish stalls lined the main road, alongside photographic studios offering tourist snaps of couples standing rigidly on the sand. Housing and expansion in Great Yarmouth had for a long time been constrained by the medieval walls that surrounded the original town, and as such, large portions dated back as far as the 11th century. One of the more infamous areas of Great Yarmouth was known as the Rose, where housing had been built from north to south along the River Yare in long terraces, divided by tight lanes paved with beach pebbles, some narrow enough that one was able to stand in the middle, stretch their arms out from the sides, and touch a house with either hand. Special carts were necessary to transport goods, known as troll carts, in place of a traditional horse and cart that were just naturally far too wide to pass down the average row. Over 2,500 houses, which by the 20th century were rapidly deteriorating, were crammed into 145 rows that hadn't been officially numbered until the early 19th century, meaning that for centuries, this labyrinthine streets were almost unnavigable by an outsider, who would have seen and heard little more than a winding hodgepodge of local names that frequently referred to well-known merchants, pubs, shops or residents who resided in each row. Mr. and Mrs. Rudrum occupied a narrow, four-storey house on row 104, once known as Swanard's Row, towards the southern end of the tightly packed lanes. At night, the light from one of only two gas lights that lit the narrow alleyway might have just about crept to the door of number 3, where the Rudrums operated a cramped lodging house throughout the summer months that, despite the almost slum-like conditions, had been regularly booked by tourists visiting the town in search of their salt water and sea air cure. John Rudrum worked as a shoemaker, and alongside himself and his wife Eliza, the house was occupied by their 20-year-old daughter, Alice, her 6 younger siblings, and Eliza's elderly mother, making for a tightly packed stay. By September of 1900, the summer season was beginning to wind down. That year had seen a heatwave across Norfolk, engulfing Great Yarmouth in scorching temperatures throughout the majority of July. And whilst that September had still been warmer than usual, visitors to the town had slowly begun to dry up. When Mrs. Hood, carrying her infant child, arrived at the Rudrams' doorstep on the evening of Saturday the 15th of September, Mrs. Rudram had been able to offer her the house's best room, the only other lodger being a man with his two young sons. At the time, Mrs. Rudram had just been happy to have such a busy house, despite the holiday season drawing to a close. Little did she know that by taking in the young Mrs. Hood, she was opening her door to far more than a young woman with a baby, and that she would soon find herself embroiled in the thick of a drama that would play out across the next 6 months in a sensational mystery that would capture the nation's interest. The morning of Sunday the 23rd of September was another clear day in the fading summer of 1900. The sun had risen at 6:15, and in the gloom of dawn, 14-year-old John Norton was walking along the beach at Yarmouth on his way to Hewitt's bathing huts, where he had been working for the summer season. As he stared out across the sand towards the still grey sea, he saw what he thought was a woman asleep on the sand on a nearby sandhill. When he arrived at work, he told Mr. Grief, the bathing chalet manager, about this woman, and Mr. Grief told him to go and see if he could wake her. On his way back, he jumped down from the parade onto the sand and walked nearer to the woman, who had still not moved, before realising with some horror that the woman was not sleeping. Rather, she looked quite dead. Laid out on her back, her face was bruised, and she had what looked like a bootlace tied around her neck. John stumbled backwards, and then, climbing to his feet, he leapt up onto the parade and ran straight to the nearby lifeboat station, where he met Police Constable Edwin Manship and explained what he had just discovered. The pair made their way back to the body, and when he had confirmed the find, Manship sent John into town to fetch a horse and cart from the local fish transporter William Woods. As soon as John had left the beach, PC Manship set about documenting as much of the scene as he could, knowing that he would have to move the body as soon as possible so as not to panic the holidaymakers that would soon be arriving for their early morning trip to the bathing machines. Looking around the woman's body, he noticed that the sand was disturbed in several places, leading him to believe that there had been something of a struggle. A white straw hat lay on the ground next to the body, which was dressed in a grey skirt that had been hitched up around her legs, her bloomers left tangled around her ankles. Her shoes were relatively new-looking, clean, and, upon check-in, had both laces intact. Around 5'2" tall, the woman seemed young. Manship estimated probably less than 30 years old, and she had several rings on her fingers, one of which looked to be a wedding ring. In her pockets, he found a pair of brown gloves, and rolling over the body, he found a small white handkerchief pressed into the sand. It was just turning 7 a.m. when John returned, accompanied by William and his cart, and two more police officers. The sun had been up for an hour now, and the early morning light was crisp. Anxious to get a move on, PC Manship loaded up the body onto the car and began the slow journey to the North Quay mortuary, arriving 45 minutes later. The police surgeon, Dr. Thomas Lettice, arrived shortly after and performed a preliminary examination, concluding that the woman had probably been dead around 6 to 7 hours, and that she had more than likely been murdered, though, bizarrely, the police were not completely ruling out a suicide, since she had no defensive wounds on her hands or arms. This was all despite the fact that the lace that had been tied around her neck was so tight that it would have been near impossible for a person to have tied it on themselves. Frank Sayers, a local photographer from one of the several beachside photography studios, arrived at the mortuary a little after the doctor in order to photograph the body's eyes. This was a process known as optography that had gained some traction in the late 19th century. Essentially, practitioners believed that the retina of a victim's eyes recorded an image of the last scene that they saw before death, which could potentially be reviewed in a close-up photograph. Sadly, the images came up blank, which was concluded to have been due to the murder having been taken place at night, and the scene, of course, was just too dark for it to work. The presence of Frank Sayers in the mortuary and the efforts made to utilise optography went some way to show how little the police had to go on from all the information that they had uncovered so far. An identification of the woman was the most pressing concern, and fortunately for Detective Inspector Robert Lingwood, who had taken charge of the case, news travelled fast through the rows, and word was getting round that the dead lady had been lodging in a room on row 104, When he followed the rumours up, turning up at Mr. and Mrs. Rudram's that afternoon, the couple confirmed that they had taken in a lodger a week earlier, and that the young lady had gone out the night before and failed to return. Fortunately for Lingwood, the woman in question, one Mrs. Hood, had not been particularly shy with the Rudrams. Mrs. Hood had appeared late on the evening of Saturday the 15th of September with her baby daughter, which she told them was named Rose. After arriving in Great Yarmouth from London, she had not been carrying much in the way of belongings. Aside from herself and the baby, she had only bought a few small items. She was a widow from York, apparently, her husband having died 2 years earlier, and had come to Great Yarmouth with her brother-in-law, who she had met with throughout the week. She had also made a great deal about having recently spent several months travelling to South Africa. Almost immediately after paying for her room, she had put the baby to sleep and then dashed out to meet with her brother-in-law in order to take him back to the station and put him on a train for London. When she returned at midnight that night, she told Mrs. Rudram that her brother-in-law had missed the train, and so the pair had ended up going for supper and drinking until late at night. When Mrs. Hood finally returned to the lodgings, somewhat the worse for drink, she told Mrs. Rudram that her brother-in-law had checked in at a nearby hotel instead. She had spent most days for the rest of the week alone with their baby, though she had gone out most nights to meet with her mysterious brother-in-law, always returning by 9 p.m. In truth, Mrs. Rudram suspected that her brother-in-law was harbouring an unhealthy interest in Mrs. Hood, but she was sure that Mrs. Hood herself was a ladylike and respectable young woman, even if some of the things that she said were a bit strange, like how she frequently contradicted details about her life, including her age, and for how many years that she said that she'd been married, both of which she seemed to change depending on who asked her and when. Mrs. Rudram also handed a letter to the police, postmarked from Woolwich and addressed to Mrs. Hood at the Rudram's lodging house. Mrs. Rudram told police that Mrs. Hood had said it was sent to her from her brother-in-law and that it had been signed simply Hood. The letter opened a new line of inquiry, with the police hoping to search Woolwich for a Mr. Hood. However, they found themselves hampered by the Sunday Telegraph service, which slowed their initial searches. In Mrs. Hood's room in the Rudram's house, Lingwood found a photograph of the victim, taken a few days earlier by a beachside photographer. There was a small purse containing a key, a return train ticket to Liverpool Street Station in London that expired on the 25th of September, and a small gold brooch. He also found a laundry mark with the numbers 599 inside the lining of Rose's baby's clothes that matched perfectly with the laundry mark discovered on the victim's dress. That evening, Mr. Rudram accompanied Lingwood to the mortuary where he viewed the victim's body and positively identified it as his lodger, Mrs. Hood. For a single day's work, the police had had a lot to be pleased with. They had discovered the victim's identity at least, but any motive or suspects was still as yet a mystery. Alice Rudram, Mrs. Rudram's daughter, had told the police a curious story that she had overheard Mrs. Hood talking to a man outside in the narrow lane below her bedroom window on Friday night. She hadn't caught much of the conversation, but had distinctly heard the man say, "You understand, I am placed in an awkward position just now." The two then kissed, and the man bade her good night. It was a curious tale, but it was vague and lacked detail, and overall it didn't help the investigation much. As word of the murder spread throughout the town, several people contacted the police with information that they thought might possibly be a lead. A man named William Clay handed in a pair of gold-rimmed glasses that he found on the beach nearby where the body of Mrs. Hood had been found, and later that day, Mrs. Rudram was able to positively identify them as having belonged to her lodger. Perhaps more interestingly, however, was the story of Alfred Mason and his girlfriend, Blanche Smith. The couple had been on the beach the previous evening at around 10:45 p.m., After they had been there for about 15 minutes, they heard what they thought was a woman screaming, "Mercy," and then moaning. Not wanting to interfere in another couple's business, and likely experiencing a heavy dose of Victorian prudishness, Alfred, who told the police that he thought it was a man having a connection with a woman, convinced Blanche the cries were nothing more nefarious, and the two left the beach, passing right by this other couple. They saw the woman lying on the ground, and the man hovering on top of her. Blanche told the police that she thought that he was kneeling on her chest. Unfortunately for the police, neither Alfred nor Blanche got a good look at the man's face. The next day, Monday the 24th of September, the story hit the local papers with a bang. A murdered woman found on the beach was big news for Great Yarmouth, and the discovery of the body and subsequent investigation was detailed in a full-length column, so that by the end of the day, half of Yarmouth knew as much about the case as the police themselves. Unfortunately for everyone, all that they thought they knew was not necessarily the truth at all. Following the identification of Mrs. Hood, the police shifted their efforts into discovering the identity of her mysterious brother-in-law. Having heard from Mrs. Rodrum that Mrs. Hood had told her that her brother had booked a night in a hotel, they kicked off their search by touring the local establishments to look into their records for any visitors named Hood. Unfortunately, they all proved fruitless. However, a worker from a hotel named the Crown and Anchor recalled a man staying on the night of the murder who had come in late and left very early the next morning, not leaving a name at all. Police had been going door to door, laboriously making their way through the rows, but no one seemed to have seen nor heard anything unusual on the night of the murder, and no one seemed to recognise the photograph of Mrs. Hood. For a while, the police held hope that the fact that Mrs. Hood's ticket had been for a first-class carriage meant that it may have distinguished her from an ordinary rail customer, and when a second rail ticket was found to have been bought at the train station at the same time as the one found in Mrs. Hood's room, there was brief excitement, but it was quickly quelled when it was found that there was no record as to who had bought it and no one seemed to remember. With local inquiries turning towards a dead end, the police disseminated the beachfront photo of Mrs. Hood and her baby nationwide, hoping to appeal to any family that she may have had who could claim the body. The following day, a full post-mortem examination was carried out, where the obvious was finally concluded that, due to bruising on her thighs, clear signs of a sexual assault, and the fact that the bootlace had been a full 4 inches shorter in circumference than Mrs. Hood's neck, showing just how tight it had to have been pulled, suicide was categorically ruled out, with the cause of death officially recorded as strangulation. On Tuesday, the police extended their local search to the nearby pubs and inns, and very quickly they found some success. The landlord, William Borking, at the Mariner's Compass, a small bar just off the seafront, recognised the photo of Mrs. Hood as a customer who had visited his bar late on Saturday night. She had come in and had a drink at around 9:45 p.m, with a man who he described as having a heavy moustache and wearing a steel-coloured suit and a trilby hat. He ordered a gin and a whisky, and curiously, Borking thought that the man had looked quite nervous the whole time that he was in the pub. He had leafed through a train timetable on the bar before drinking up and then leaving with the woman 10 minutes later. Wednesday evening led to a tantalising story coming from the nearby town of Lowestoft, 10 miles south down the coast from Great Yarmouth, after a newsagent named John O'Driscoll informed the police of a customer who had come into his station as late that evening asking for a newspaper that had had the best coverage of the Yarmouth Beach murder. The story was big news throughout the local area, so it may not have been such a strange request had the man not had scratches across his face and hands, which, to Mr. O'Driscoll at least, looked a few days old. O'Driscoll had handed him a copy of the Ipswich Star, and as soon as he had paid, the man flipped the pages open, right there in the shop, and began scouring the pages. When he noticed the newsagent staring at him, he promptly flipped the paper shut and stormed out of the shop. As he left, O'Driscoll thought he could see the tongue of one of his boots sticking out, possibly suggesting that he was missing a lace. It was a fascinating story, but like so much of the information that the police had so far gathered, it was decided that it was too vague to give the police any real leads. The inquest, which had initially been held back to give the police chance to uncover more evidence, finally commenced on Thursday the 27th of September at 4 p.m. in the Magistrates' Court, located in the Great Yarmouth Town Hall. The fact that the inquest was being held for the death of a woman, name unknown, was testament to how little the police still knew about the whole affair, with the coroner, Mr. Tolvar Waters, admitting at the outset that the jury probably knew as much about the case as he did. One new detail, however, was that the bootlace found around the neck of the victim had either snapped and been tied back together, or had actually been two laces tied together in order to make it long enough to wrap fully around the neck. The jury were marched up to the mortuary, where they viewed the body, before the inquest resumed with the evidence from the Rodrum family, followed by a short description of his discovery of the body from John Norton. At the end of the day, the inquest was adjourned until the following day, where PC Manship gave his testimony of the murder scene, followed by medical evidence given by Dr. Lettuce. The inquest was once more adjourned, and that afternoon, the body of the mysterious Mrs. Hood was laid to rest. The tolling of a muffled bell from the tower of St. Nicholas Church on Friday afternoon was almost the only indication of the funeral of the victim of Sunday's tragedy. It was the wish of the police authorities that the funeral should be kept as quiet as possible, and as a consequence, there was a very small attendance at the church. Indeed, beyond Mrs. Rudram, the woman at whose house the deceased was lodging, and her daughter, the church was practically empty. The body was removed from the mortuary in the small hand hearse which is kept there, and was met at the church by the Reverend H.B. Rivington, one of the curates of the church, who conducted the service. The coffin, which was of red deal, was not moved from the hearse until at the graveside, where a large number of people had congregated. There, the customary burial service was read by the Reverend H.B. Rivington. The funeral marked something of a temporary end to the press excitement that had swirled around the case. With no evidence or leads to follow up, new information had quickly evaporated, leaving a void that could only be filled by a few of the sensationalist weekend penny papers, one of which had offered a £5 reward for any information on the identity of the victim, alongside a crude line drawing of the beach photograph of Mrs. Hood with her baby. By mid-October, everything had fallen quiet on the investigation, following the conclusion of the inquest, which had ruled the case willful murder against some person or persons unknown. With all their resources exhausted, the local police called in Scotland Yard to help get the case moving again, fronted out by Chief Inspector Alfred Leach. From the outset, Leach decided to focus on two leads that he thought had been neglected by the local Yarmouth police. Firstly, the laundry mark that had been found on both the victim and the baby's clothing. And secondly, the victim's trip to South Africa that she had told Mrs. Rudram about in the week before her murder. A facsimile of the laundry mark was distributed to several of the national papers, along with a request for any information on who the mark may have belonged to. Detectives were then assigned areas throughout London, with each detective tasked with scouring the laundries in their area. Detective Sergeant Bartle had been assigned to pore across all the laundries in Bexley Heath in southeast London, where he came across a single laundry that used the mark 599 run by a Mr. John Savage. Bartle checked in on the laundry, but didn't have a chance to speak to the owner. Instead, he questioned the manager, who was unable to identify the picture of the mark found on Mrs. Hood's clothing, nor did she recognise the name Hood at all. They did have a customer assigned to the number 599, though their name was Bennett, and they'd been sending in washing as usual, even after the murder of Mrs. Hood. Meanwhile, whilst Bartle was in Bexley Heath, passenger lists of ships sailing to and from South Africa were being dug into, which turned up a Mr. and Mrs. Hood, who had travelled together aboard the steamship Geiger that had sailed to Cape Town on the 17th of March. The travel company's employees were questioned, and somewhat amazingly, Walter Penton of the accounting department said he not only recognised the name Hood, but he remembered the passengers as well, as Mr. Hood had had a strange label on his travelling case. The top layer of the label had been etched Mr. Hood, but it had been partially torn, and underneath, Walter had been able to make out a second name, Bennett. The ticket sales were traced back to the Jacob & Company travel agents, and the banknotes used to pay for the tickets were then traced to a branch of the Lloyds Bank in Woolwich, where they discovered that they were withdrawn by a Mr. Bennett. Immediately recognising the name from the laundry, Bartle returned to Bexley Heath, where this time he got a chance to speak to the owner, who had instantly recognised the lady in the beach photograph as his customer, Mrs. Bennett. The Bennett's laundry had continued recently, he explained, but it had actually stopped sometime in mid-September for a week or so, and after restarting, it had been very different clothes, now being mainly men's collars and shirts. In what was a fortunate coincidence for the police, Mr. Savage said that he was able to recognise Mrs. Bennett so easily because he'd actually lived next door to her and her baby, which was actually named Ruby, not Rose. Finally, it seemed like the police had the true identity of the victim. She was the 23-year-old Mary Jane Bennett. But why she had wanted to keep that much a secret was still anyone's guess. Before long, the entire history of Mary Jane Bennett was being uncovered by a press who had found a renewed interest in the case. Born on the 23rd of August, 1877, Mary Jane Bennett had been raised by her grandparents after her mother had deserted her family and left Mary Jane with her father. Not being expected to raise a child by himself, Mary Jane's father left his daughter with his parents, whilst he went off and remarried, building a new family. Mary Jane, meanwhile, grew up to be a gifted musician, playing both violin and piano, and despite being partially deaf, began fostering a music career by her early teens, playing as a soloist in concert halls around southeast London. By 18 years old, she had started working as a piano teacher in her grandparents' parlour above a butcher shop, which is where she met Herbert John Bennett, a 16-year-old assistant at the Royal Arsenal Cooperative Society, who became one of Mary's violin students in order to keep the relationship under wraps. Before long, the two were engaged in secret, which was all well and good, until Mary Jane fell pregnant in 1897, somewhat forcing their hand into marriage. Herbert lied about his age on the marriage papers, and the two were due to be wed, when Herbert's father found out and objected on account of Herbert only being 17 and of having no money to support a family. Not one to be deterred, Herbert moved out of home and rented a room in the East End of London, near the Royal Victoria Docks, and the two married at a registry office in secret, with Herbert artificially aging himself to 21 and falsely declaring his father dead. Unsurprisingly, the marriage was not set to begin on the best footing, but things rapidly deteriorated after Herbert lost his job, leading the couple to move back in with Mary Jane's grandmother. Shortly after, Mary Jane's baby was stillborn, and then, soon after that, her grandmother passed away in 1898. The butcher shop that they had been living above was left to Mary Jane's father, who had taken a dislike to Herbert, thinking him lazy, and so chose to evict his own daughter and her husband. Fortunately, Mary Jane had been left £15 from her grandmother, and so the two were able to rent a small greengrocer's near Battersea, which they lived above, until Herbert ran the shop into the ground. It was possibly this failure in business that acted as a trigger that turned Herbert violent, and several people reported that he would frequently threaten and beat Mary Jane. At one point, he even threatened Mary Jane's father with a revolver after he had been turned away from their house following Herbert's attempt to retrieve a piano that Mary Jane's grandmother had left Mary Jane. And then suddenly, just like that, Herbert and Mary Jane seemed to come into a significant amount of money. Mary Jane had fallen pregnant again, and after the two moved to a fancy neighbourhood in Hammersmith, they took on the services of a private doctor who oversaw the birth of Ruby on 13th of October 1898. As it happened, Mary Jane and Herbert had come up with a plan together and had been combining Mary Jane's knowledge of music along with Herbert's connections and business acumen to deal in antique violins and pianos. This was all well and good, except that they were not really antiques. Herbert had been busy acquiring cheap, mass-produced instruments, and then Mary Jane had been selling them off to unsuspecting customers via newspaper advertisements, usually selling the instrument along with some sort of sob story. One example of this was an advertisement placed in the Exchange and Mart on the 18th of August that offered a fine old violin, bow, case, strings, tuning fork, chin rest, etc. from a widow lady who was simply looking for a quick sale. Much of Herbert's business, however, had been done on credit, and with debt piling up, Herbert and Mary Jane decided to hightail it out of London, telling their landlady they were moving to Taunton to open a music shop, and then moving to Westgate-on-Sea, where they purchased a new greengrocer's instead, which they promptly burnt down. Of course, they made sure to insure it first. Despite the local fire service deeming the fire unsatisfactory after the preceding investigation found a pile of rubbish that had been lit under the counter, the insurance company settled the contract for £208, which, along with the sale of stock that they had not yet paid for, put the Bennetts well into profit from the affair. A month after the fire, baby Ruby was dropped off with Herbert's parents, whilst Herbert and Mary Jane, disguised with wigs and false names, travelled to Southampton and then fled the country for South Africa. The trip was short-lived, and the pair travelled back to England just 4 days after arriving, returning to Southampton on the 9th of May. Looking to settle down in England, Herbert and Mary Jane set up a new home in Plumstead, just outside of Woolwich, in the southeast of London, and Herb went back to working as a grocer in a nearby cooperative store. The chaotic few months had done little for their relationship, and before long, Herbert and Mary Jane were arguing again, until eventually the couple seemed to decide on some sort of amicable separation, with Mary Jane moving to Bexley Heath and Herbert moving into his own place in Woolwich, where he got a job as a labourer at the Royal Arsenal. Herbert still visited Mary Jane once a week, with Mary Jane telling her new landlady that he was a travelling salesman to explain his absence. Whether or not that was all he was doing for money is anyone's guess, but the Bennetts somehow seemed to be doing quite well for themselves, despite Herbert renting two homes and paying for himself, Mary Jane and Ruby. In his time in Woolwich, Herbert paraded around in tailored suits and his landlady described him as the nicest lodger that she had ever had. With so much time away from Mary Jane, however, it was easy to guess that Herbert had started a second life with a parlour maid from Stepney named Alice Meadows, whom he told he was a violin trader and had inherited £500 from his recently deceased mother. In the few months that he knew Alice, he took her on holiday to Great Yarmouth and Ireland, proposing to her whilst away on the latter trip with a diamond and ruby ring. The problem for Herbert, however, was the small fact that he was still married to Mary Jane. When he returned from his holiday to Ireland, he began preparing to take another holiday with Mary Jane, who had recently recovered from a severe bout of flu and wanted to experience some of the clean sea air. On Saturday the 15th of September, Mary Jane travelled to Great Yarmouth and took lodgings with Mr. and Mrs. Rudram under the name of Hood. That week, Herbert went to work at the Royal Arsenal as usual, until Saturday, where he told Alice that he would be visiting his dying grandfather in Gravesend. That night, Mary Jane was murdered on the beach of Great Yarmouth. In the days following Mary Jane's murder, Herbert did several strange things. Firstly, he cancelled Mary Jane's tenancy, telling the landlord that she was leaving for America. He then proceeded to sell off the majority of her belongings, including a bicycle and piano, giving several of her old items of clothing to Alice as gifts. Meanwhile, the police were scrabbling around in Great Yarmouth, looking for the killer of his now dead wife. When the police became aware of the Bennett name and Woolwich connection, things suddenly moved much more swiftly, and within days, Chief Inspector Leach and Detective Sergeant Holford were questioning Herbert's colleagues at the cooperative, before arresting Herbert on the streets of Woolwich on suspicion of the murder of Mary Jane Bennett. When Herbert arrived at the police station in Woolwich, he denied all accusations against him, saying that he hadn't lived with Mary Jane for months and that he'd never even been to Great Yarmouth and absolutely not murdered her. He told the police that he'd recently found letters in Mary Jane's clothes written to her from another man. Unfortunately for Herbert, several people were brought in to identify him as having been in Great Yarmouth, so his denials seemed somewhat lacking in integrity. His clothes also bore the 599 laundry mark, entangling him even more with the case. When the police searched his room that afternoon, they found a revolver, a pair of well-worn wigs, several shirts with the damning laundry mark, a gold chain, a silver watch, and just to really rub it in, a receipt from a hotel in Great Yarmouth. It was all looking pretty bleak for Herbert, and his situation didn't improve when Alice Meadows arrived, only to be told that not only had her sweetheart been arrested for murder, but the shawl that she was wearing had to be handed over to the police as evidence, having once belonged to Herbert's murdered wife. Amazingly, despite all of this terribly awkward situation, Alice stood by Herbert, believing him when he pleaded his innocence. Later that week, police smuggled Herbert aboard a train in an effort to conceal him from the crowds that had gathered outside the station, hoping to catch a glimpse of the suspect, and he was escorted back to Great Yarmouth in order to prepare him for a trip up in front of the magistrates at the town hall that Friday, on the 9th of November. Without any defence, Herbert was advised against making any statements of his own, and so he watched on as the charges were read against him. When the gold chain and silver watch that the police had found in his room were introduced into evidence, having been identified as belonging to Mary Jane by Mrs. Rudram, Herbert shouted out that Mary Jane had not worn them for more than 12 months. With the initial officialities out of the way, Herbert was remanded until the following Friday, when the magistrates hoped that the police would be able to offer more evidence to the court. Over the following days, the police did their best to gather as much evidence against Herbert as possible, though for the most part, it seemed to entail rather shaky eyewitness testimony and unconvinced identifications, whilst the newspapers did their absolute best to sensationalise the case, printing reams of copy, much of it based on little else than gossip. Alice Meadows gave an interview to the London Echo, which led to papers across the country spinning speculative stories about Herbert's life. The Echo's interview focused heavily on Alice's views of Herbert and on her belief in his innocence. There is no more pathetic figure connected with this very remarkable mystery than Miss Meadows, who believes implicitly in the innocence of her lover so far as the baser crime of murder is concerned. "I know that he has wronged me and deceived me," she exclaimed amidst a flood of tears, "but I cannot believe, and what is more, I will not believe, that he has descended to killing a poor defenceless woman." Interestingly, Alice told the press about a moment a week after the murder when Herbert had been visiting her family at home, when Alice's sister read out from the paper a story concerning the murder in Great Yarmouth, and when she looked over to Herbert, found that he did not appear at all concerned or uneasy. Meanwhile, the police were busy taking testimony from witnesses who claimed to have seen Herbert in Great Yarmouth on the weekend of the murder. A station worker claimed to have seen him board a train on Sunday morning, though he could not be sure 100% that it was the same man as the prisoner. Another witness, this time from the Crown and Anchor Hotel in Great Yarmouth, gave a positive identification of Herbert and told the police that he had seen him arrive, puffing heavily and out of breath, just before midnight on Saturday night. Another staff member said he remembered him too, and he was sure that he'd stayed before, in fact, only at that time he'd been in the company of another woman. The landlord, Borkin, who had served drinks to Mary Jane and her male companion on the night of her murder, also positively identified Herbert as the man who had been with her, though he wasn't convinced that he looked completely alike, stating that he thought the man had a much fuller moustache than Herbert. All the while, the testimonies rolled in. Herbert continued to deny everything and proposed new alibis to the police, saying that he'd been drinking with a pair of old work colleagues from the cooperative and he was adamant that they would back his story up. That Friday, he was back in front of the magistrates once more, but the police still had little more than circumstantial evidence to go on. Herbert's father had finally arranged for a defence lawyer to be present, named Edward L.V. Robb, who did his best to earn his fee from the start of the proceedings, damning all of the newspaper gossip and speculation, and doing his best to assure the jury that none of the stories that had been written about Herbert in the past few weeks had any shred of truth to them. Given the lack of physical evidence, the police were not entirely confident, and their concerns were only made stronger after Mary Jane's father was shown the gold chain and silver watch taken from Herbert's room, both of which he was supposed to have bought for Mary Jane himself, and was unable to identify either. Things didn't go all Herbert's way either, however, especially when his old work colleagues smashed his alibi by confirming that they had not been out drinking with him in Woolwich during the night of the murder. The next day, L.V. Robb thanked the jury for their cooperation, and the verdict was given. Herbert John Bennett, you are committed to take your trial at the next Norwich Assizes on the charge of feloniously and of malice afterthought killing and murdering your wife on the beach in this town on the night of September the 23rd, 1900. Herbert was then escorted from the court and back to his cell, where he was to await trial. Following the trial, one of the first things that Edward L.V. Robb did was to put in an application to move the trial from the Norwich Assizes to the Central Criminal Court at the Old Bailey. This was on the grounds that, with all the local press having been writing about the case for weeks already, it would be impossible to hold a local trial without any prejudice. The application was granted, and Herbert was transferred to Newgate Prison, where he sat for several months, waiting for the trial to begin. In the run-up, tickets were issued to would-be attendees. However, only men were eligible, as the case was deemed too sensitive for female sensibilities. Given the fact that it was mostly women who liked to attend court trials, this naturally didn't go down particularly well, and some women did their best to sneak in all the same. Finally, after months of sitting around, Herbert entered the courtroom of the Old Bailey, apparently looking bright and neat, at 11 a.m. on Monday the 25th of February 1901, alongside his defence barrister, who had been paid for by anonymous public donations, Edward Marshall Hall. Hall was a dramatic and exceptionally gifted speaker who would go on to be known as the Great Defender due to his talent in defending particularly infamous murderers, including Ronald Light, the defendant in the Green Bicycle case of 1919. Hall knew very well that the prosecution against Herbert was based almost entirely on eyewitness testimony, 52 eyewitnesses to be exact, and his plan was set accordingly. The first day opened with a long, drawn-out speech from the prosecution that spent over 2.5 hours detailing the evidence against Herbert. At the very first opportunity, Hall laid out one of the key cards to his hand, complaining about a leaflet that had been printed and disseminated throughout London concerning the case, and expressing his anger and disappointment that Herbert had been portrayed with such sensationalism. It was a shrewd move, especially given the fact that the Lord Chief Justice agreed, calling the press highly improper. That afternoon, further evidence was detailed, including the showcasing of the bootlace that had been used to strangle Mary Jane. Among the first witnesses to be called were PC Manship and the young John Norton, who had discovered the body. During the medical evidence from Dr. Lettice, Hall once more attacked, asking questions in his cross-examination that suggested the murder had been the outcome of a violent and botched sexual assault. But it was when the gold chain that had been discovered in Herbert's room was shown as evidence that Hall really showed his big hand. Knowing full well that the gold chain and silver watch were the only physical pieces of evidence in the case, Hall opened fire, suggesting that the gold chain in Herbert's room was not the same gold chain that people had seen Mary Jane wearing during her time in Great Yarmouth. When an almost life-size enlargement of the beachside photograph was entered into the court, Hall pointed out the design of the links and said that it was his belief that the chain Mary Jane had been wearing was of a rope design and not the link design that had been discovered in Herbert's room. It was a line of attack that would end up being one of the most controversial aspects of the trial and would take up a great deal of time throughout. When William Clark, Mary Jane's father, gave evidence around the silver watch, Hall struck again when he was able to get William to admit that he could not be 100% sure that the watch was the same watch that he had gifted to his daughter himself, as he had only seen it twice in 11 years. In one afternoon, Hall had successfully cast doubt over the only two pieces of physical evidence that the prosecution had, and when the court adjourned for the day, he must have felt he had gone a long way to earning his fee. The second day of the trial resumed the next morning, with the crowds outside the court likened to the first night at the theatre. The fortunate onlookers, who had secured themselves seats inside, saw another long string of witnesses presented for the prosecution, this time mostly focusing on Herbert's character, painting him as a sketchy con man who had swindled people into purchasing phony antique instruments and had fostered an abusive and at times violent relationship with Mary Jane. Mrs. Elliston, a former landlord to the Bennets, told the court of how she had overheard Herbert yelling, "Damn you and the baby," at Mary Jane on the first night that they arrived at her lodging house, and that he was not at all kind. She also said that Mary Jane was frequently crying and at one point had told her that Herbert had hit her in the face. Mrs. Elliston also gave a positive identification to the contentious watch and chain, saying that the watch had the baby's teeth marks in it from where it would frequently play with it. Hall wasted no time in digging into her during the cross-examination, calling her out for having spoken to the press in the run-up to the trial and for having read about the case in the papers extensively. When she eventually broke down in tears, his contempt was visible for all to see when he simply said, "Ah, yes, the common refuge of your sex," earning him a scolding from the judge. After she had composed herself, Hall continued his cross-examination, eventually forcing Miss Elliston to admit that she had spoken at length to the press about the Bennets' relationship after a journalist had tricked her into believing that he was a member of the police force. It was another win for Hall, who removed blame from Mrs. Elliston herself and placed it instead at the feet of the press. At the same time, he was showing just how compromised the witnesses in the case had become from the very outset. When William Clark was recalled later that day, Hall moved on to breaking down the supposed motive for Herbert having killed his wife, by showing that his marriage to Mary Jane had been legally void from the start, given how he had falsified his age. If his marriage was not legally binding, then why would Herbert have needed to kill her in order to escape the relationship and marry Alice Meadows? Next, Hall cross-examined Henry Horton, the bookkeeper at the Royal Arsenal where Herbert had worked. As the bookkeeper, Horton had full records of Herbert's presence and absences from work. As it turned out, Herbert had not been at work on the 15th until the 17th of September, the 15th being the Saturday that Mary Jane travelled to Great Yarmouth, and he was absent again from 8 p.m. on Saturday the 22nd till Monday the 24th of September, which covered the night of the murder. Whilst this might have seemed like a loss for Hall, he was all too happy to point out that if Herbert had been working in the days between, then it could not have been Herbert that Alice Rudrum had overheard Mary Jane speaking to in the narrow alleyway beneath her bedroom window on the Friday evening before she was murdered. If that was the case, then who exactly was this mystery man, and where was he now? As the days ticked by, the excitement for the trial had only continued to grow, and by the third day, crowds outside the court were reaching fever pitch as the police struggled to escort the jury through the main entrance. The third day saw Alice Meadows on the stand to give her testimony, an event which had been much looked forward to, given the fervour for which she still seemed to support Herbert, despite his circumstances. When Hall cross-examined her, he made a special effort to have Herbert painted as in an entirely different light, asking questions as to how he had always treated her, both in their relationship and especially when they were away on holiday together. Alice was only too happy to explain that Herbert had always been nothing but the most absolute gentleman towards her. Far from the violent and abusive monster that the prosecution had so far shown him as, Alice, with the aid of Hall, said that he was instead kind, well-behaved, affectionate and genial in every way. He was, Alice Meadows told the court, everything I could wish for. The remainder of the day fell to Hall to dismantle witness after witness from Great Yarmouth, including Mr. Rudram, who he forced to admit had been talking to others extensively about the case, and William Borking, the landlord at the Mariner's Compass, that had supposedly served Mary Jane and a man drinks on the night of the murder, who Hall painted as untrustworthy due to his interest in spiritualism. In one particularly important moment, Hall had Borking admit that Herbert's moustache looked much thinner now than the one the man in his bar had been sporting, despite it already being confirmed that Herbert had not changed his moustache since the time of the murder. When Hall cross-examined Mrs. Rudram, she initially said that she was unable to identify the gold chain as the one that Mary Jane had worn during her stay, though she later grew more into her statement and said that she was now sure that it was the very same, although she was still unable to positively identify the silver watch. When Alice Rudram took the stand, she initially identified the chain with no trouble at all. However, during a particularly confusing cross-examination from Hall, she eventually agreed with him that it did not match with the rope chain in the blown-up photograph. He then confirmed with Alice that the man and woman she had overheard speaking under her bedroom window had absolutely been Mary Jane, which she confirmed, saying that she had no doubt. Just to hammer the point home, Hall then asked her if she was aware that Herbert was at work during the time the mysterious conversation had been happening. As the day continued, Hall continued to undermine the witness testimony, one after another. The railway worker, who claimed to have seen Herbert board the first train from Great Yarmouth on the Sunday morning at 7:20 a.m, went on to tell the court that that train had arrived in London 1 minute late at 11:31 a.m. This was a journey that would not have been at all unusual, but the problem with that timing was that the next witness, Alice Meadows' mother, confirmed that Herbert had arrived at her house on Sunday morning at 11:30, meaning it would have been impossible for him to have been aboard the first train away from Great Yarmouth that morning, which came awfully close to suggesting that Herbert had something resembling the foundations of an alibi. As the case for the prosecution wore on, however, it always seemed to come back to the identity of the gold chain as the principal piece of evidence. Towards the end of the fourth day, the prosecution called in expert testimony from a photographer who they had tasked with photographing the gold chain under different conditions to see if movement during the exposure, for example, from someone breathing, could blur the image of the chain sufficiently for it to appear like a rope chain rather than one with links. Hall immediately objected to this evidence on the ground that no member of the defence had been present when the experiments were carried out. But it was for naught, and the photographer was allowed to conclude that it was his belief that no certainty in the style of chain could be brought, simply on the beach photograph alone. Once the expert testimony concluded, it was time for Hall to step up and present his case for the defence, which he began at the close of the fourth day, postponing his opening speech until the following morning, and instead he immediately brought in his own expert witness, a jeweller from Covent Garden in London, who said that he was sure that the chain in the photograph was a rope style, and more specifically, he even named the design as an example of a Prince of Wales chain. Hall then had a second expert corroborate the evidence. It was another strong finish to the day for Hall and the prosecution, who entered the last days of the trial with some confidence. The fifth day saw Hall launch into his opening speech by damning the press surrounding the trial for causing Herbert irreparable harm, and he told the court of how he had been forced to prepare the defence in utmost secrecy in order to keep every detail from being leaked to the public beforehand. Several witnesses were then called before Hall finally decided to play his strongest hand, announcing to the court, "I shall call before you a gentleman, Mr. Sholto Douglas, who was with Bennett at 7 o'clock on the night of the murder. It is impossible, therefore, that Bennett can be the murderer of his wife." Douglas Sholto Douglas was a 29-year-old London merchant who had read about the Bennett case in the papers, and putting two and two together, and realising that the man accused, Herbert, was, in fact, the very same man that he had met whilst out walking, and that given the last train to Great Yarmouth that Saturday evening was at 5 o'clock, it was simply impossible for Herbert to have been the murderer. The meeting on the night of the murder was brought about in a curious manner. Mr. Sholto Douglas was a man of some means. He kept a servant and was an amateur gardener. On this fatal evening, he was taking a country walk between 6 and 7, and a man, Bennett, came up and asked him for a light for his cigarette. Mr. Douglas gave him one, and then Bennett engaged the gentleman in conversation, and in this way walked some distance with the prisoner. Then Mr. Douglas endeavoured to shake the stranger, Bennett, off, but Bennett did not take the hint. Bennett told Mr. Douglas that he had been to Ireland and other things about his life, and the two remained in conversation until they arrived at the Tiger Tavern. Here again, Mr. Douglas made a futile attempt to get rid of the stranger, but Bennett, either not noticing the hint or entirely ignoring it, still kept on. Eventually, however, the two parted, and Mr. Douglas did not think any more of the incident until the arrest of Bennett for the Yarmouth murder. When Douglas went to see Herbert in Norwich Jail, he identified him immediately as the man from that evening, in one swoop supplying Herbert with an incredibly convenient alibi. Douglas went on to tell the court that he only learned of Herbert's name when they alighted from the Tiger Tavern and Herbert noticed a neighbouring shop, whose sign read F.K. Bennett, which led him to remark, "Oh, there seems to be a namesake of mine living up here." The prosecution cross-examined Douglas for almost 30 minutes, but he was impossible to shake from his original story. Following the alibi bombshell, Hall then called several witnesses who worked to cast Herbert in a better light, and unsurprisingly, worked to show Mary Jane as a difficult wife who had neglected her baby. Furthermore, the witnesses claimed that she herself was aware that her and Herbert had not been legally married, and that she had spoken on several occasions of a male friend that was not Herbert. With the trial never able to stray too far from the evidence of the gold chain, several witnesses were called to point out that Mary Jane was more fond of jewellery than the trial had so far given her credit for. Not a woman to have a single gold chain, several witnesses testified to the fact that she had had several chains, one of which she had pawned and replaced with an imitation gold chain that just so happened to have been in a rope style. It was then time for Hall to address the jury and wrap up the case for the defence. In typical dramatic fashion, his speech launched into a volley on the press. "Never in the history of the law has a prisoner been so handicapped by the most outrageous gutter rags which have circulated at night under the guise of halfpenny papers. This sensational journalism, imported from America and a disgrace to America, seems as if it will deprive England of its proudest boast, that it is the only country in the world where one can get absolute justice." He singled out one journalist, Mr. Smith of the Evening News, in particularly fanciful style. "I cannot trust myself to speak of the man in the terms in which I should like to describe him. The only word that occurs to me is the word ghoul, G-H-O-U-L. I spell it to you so that you may not mistake it. He seems like an animal that would revel in the lifeblood of his own species." Hall then tore into the mystery of the case, questioning who the man was that Alice Rudrum had heard Mary Jane speaking to, and why, if Herbert had travelled all the way to Great Yarmouth to meet Mary Jane with the intention of murdering her, would he have gone armed with only a single bootlace? It was, as far as Hall was concerned, a manner of killing which was much more likely that of an assault or robbery. And why would he have carried a gold chain and silver watch away from the scene, only to hold on to them both and allow them to incriminate him? After warming the jury up, Hall then concluded for the day, sure that he would have his case finished the following afternoon. Hall had one last surprise, however, and on the sixth day, he introduced one last witness, John O'Driscoll, the newspaperman who had sold the paper to a suspicious-looking man with scratches on his hands and face several days after the murder. O'Driscoll told the court of how he'd given his testimony to the police long ago, but nothing had ever come of it, and no one had followed it up, a confession that Chief Constable Parker was forced to admit when he confirmed to the court that he had received the testimony and that his men had followed it up as best they could. Saturday morning signalled the final day of the trial. It stirred up continued excitement throughout its 6 days, but finally Hall was standing to conclude his case in what was described as a sensational speech lasting just over 2 hours. Sure, he admitted to the court, Herbert had told a few lies to Alice Meadows. But those lies, he contended, were likely in order to cover up for the fact that he had previously been married, not that he was a cold-blooded murderer. The witness testimony, called by the prosecution, he said, was absolutely and entirely unworthy of credence. In summary, he told the court, The murder pointed to some filthy, foul and sensual crime committed by the agitated man who went into Mr. O'Driscoll's shop at Lowestoft, and having read the newspaper account of the tragedy, and who, like Jack the Ripper and others, had remained undetected and undiscovered. With the previous day's introduction of Douglas to the trial, public opinion on the guilt of Herbert was thought to have been very much divided, with many of the papers hedging their bets as to the outcome. Herbert himself had looked calm throughout the trial, and even on the last day, he seemed to be in no way disturbed by the proceedings. When the jury left the courtroom to deliberate at just after 6:30 p.m. that evening, most expected them to not return until around midnight, which is why their return just 35 minutes later came as something of a surprise. Everyone took a deep breath as the unmoved clerk, in professional fashion, rattled off the further question: do you find Herbert John Bennett guilty or not guilty? Without a pause came the awe-inspiring answer: guilty. And it sent a throb through the breast of everyone. The solemn dialogue went on, the clerk continuing: you say he is guilty of willful murder? Yes, the foreman simply said. Bennett's face blanched, but he stood firm, his attitude unchanged. Herbert was given a chance to respond, but when he stood, he simply replied, I say I am not guilty, before retaking his seat. The judge donned his black cap and gave his sentence. Herbert John Bennett, after a protracted trial, in which the jury have paid the closest attention to the evidence, and in which you have been most ably defended, and every point that could be taken for the defence has been taken, the jury have found you guilty of the murder of your wife. I can only say that after the evidence, I do not think they could possibly have returned any other verdict. I will not harrow you, or those who hear me, by referring to the terrible instance of the crime. I can only say I fear that after a career, for which not much can be said, you deliberately planned the death of this poor woman in order to achieve your own ends. I can hold out no hope for you. I implore you to make your peace with your Maker. The sentence of the law is that you be taken from this place to the place from whence you came, and from thence to the place of execution, and that you be hanged by the neck until you shall be dead, and your body shall be buried in the precincts of the prison in which you shall be confined after your conviction. May the Lord have mercy on your soul. Herbert turned away from the court and walked towards the cells without displaying any special emotion, in what was described as an air of callous hardihood that he had displayed throughout the trial. That week, the trial had made the front page of the Illustrated Police News, with most of the press largely writing in agreement of the sentence, though there were some notable detractors, specifically Douglas Sholto Douglas, who gave an interview to The Echo following the sentencing, where he remained convinced of his testimony. I am still convinced that the man whom I had a conversation and a drink with on that fatal Saturday night was Bennett. Nothing but a confession of the murder from the lips of the condemned man himself will make me believe that it was some other man other than Bennett whom I saw that evening. I shall go down to my grave. Hall immediately put in an appeal, but after writing to the Home Secretary, it was denied, and with it any hope of a retrial or of a lighter sentence. Herbert was transferred to Norwich Prison later that day, where he sat for 3 weeks, until Thursday the 21st of March, the date of his execution. For his last meal, he was served a piece of bread and a cup of tea, though he showed little appetite. At 9:15, he was visited by the sheriff, who asked him if he had any confession to make, to which he replied in the negative. The sentencing had been hard on Herbert, and he'd barely eaten in the days and weeks since the trial, and when he was led out to the scaffold, he was reported as looking pale, weak, and in a half-fainting condition. Bennett was soon on the trapdoor, and the executioner, quietly adjusting the cap, gave a last look round to see that all was in order, drew the bolt, and the unhappy man had disappeared. For some seconds, there was a convulsive movement on the rope, and those who had gathered in the cheerless prison yard slowly and sadly dispersed. Outside the jail, a crowd had gathered to witness the hoisting of the black flag. The morning was bitterly cold, but bright. In the years following the trial, Hall maintained his opinion that he truly believed Herbert Bennett to have been innocent. Several decades later, he wrote of the case and of his own theories, concluding, I do not and cannot believe that he murdered his wife. My own theory of it is that he did go to Yarmouth, that he did write the letter, and that he did take his wife out that night and gave her a drink, and that he went to the hotel, leaving her about 10:30 or 10:45 near to the Rudrams' house, and that some prowling scoundrel saw her golden hair and golden chain and beguiling her to the beach for sexual purposes, she resisting, there was a struggle, an attempted rape and murder. As to the prisoner's conduct after the murder, it is absolutely consistent with the theory that, having wished her dead over and over again, and having been at Yarmouth, he was afraid to admit that he recognised by the description in the papers that it was his wife who had been murdered. And this for two reasons, as first, he was bound to be accused of murder, and secondly, he would have to claim the body, and so have let Alice Meadows, whom he meant to marry, know that he had had a dead wife and a living child. As to the alibi, Sholto Douglas was absolutely positive. I cross-examined him for an hour, and so did Gill, but we never touched him. He was undoubtedly honest. Personally, I believe he was mistaken in the date. Curiously, there remains one final twist in the tale. 11 years after the execution, there was another murder in Yarmouth, carried out by strangling the victim with a bootlace, this time of a young domestic servant named Dora May Gray, during the early hours of the morning of Monday the 15th of July, 1912. She had last been seen out with the man aged around 35 to 40 years old, but the police never found the culprit, and despite there being little else outside of the bootlace to connect the two crimes, the murder led several papers to reopen the question of who had murdered Mary Jane Bennett, positing the concerning question that Yarmouth may well have been harbouring a murderer who had escaped justice for over a decade, and who seemed to have a taste for killing. When no further murders occurred, however, the theory was forgotten, and both murders were consigned to the pages of yesterday's news, with the lives of Mary Jane and Herbert Bennett largely forgotten for over 100 years. So that was the mysterious murder of Mary Jane Bennett, and I guess there's a fair bit to talk about after these short advert breaks. Welcome back. So yeah, classic kind of tale of Victorian murder mystery there. There is a lot about this case. So if you're interested in further reading, firstly, there's a new book that's just come out about it. I actually was sent a proof copy months ago when when I first read it. And I thought it was great. It's a good book. It's written very well. Well, I should restate. It's written in a way that I like. It's a little dry and quite matter of fact, but I like that. I'm sure I've spoken about it before, but that's my sort of style of nonfiction. So I really liked it anyway. That book's called The Mysterious Mrs. Hood by Kim Donovan, if you wanted to pick that up. And that obviously goes into a lot more detail. But there is also, if you've got access to newspaper archives, most of this story is in the newspapers because this was at such a time when you could literally find newspapers that would have pages and pages of literal word for word verbatim court transcripts. So a lot of it is actually like publicly available anyway, just in archives and stuff. And something that I think is, I guess, enjoys, you know, I enjoyed researching was reading Hall. A lot of Hall's speeches were just incredible. I mean, all lawyers have that way, don't they? Like good lawyers, that they all speak, you know, very well, right? But there's something about a kind of a lawyer of this era, their kind of floral, flowery language, and you know, just their way of words. It's quite incredible. And Hall was very dramatic and very incredible word. I included obviously that quote of him going on about you know, the press being imported from America, which is a funny quote, but it's also you know, it just goes to show how good of a speaker he was and how clever he was at manipulating, like subtly manipulating the jury, you know, using this sort of little bit of jingoism to sort of like get him on his side. It's very clever, and I really liked him. He's harsh and sometimes said things which were horrible, and I would hate to have been on the end of some of his cross-examinations because they were horrid a lot of the times. But I mean, he was so skilled in just the way he presented the case. And I have to say, after reading a lot of what he said, I tend to agree with his final conclusion that I probably don't think Bennett really did this murder. despite the fact that a lot of the circumstantial evidence clearly points to him having done it. But I guess after reading all of Hall, I just kind of agree with him. I think they did. There are a lot of sort of. I mean, so the thing is when you go back to cases of this age, it's almost just like flipping a coin, because so when all the evidence is circumstantial, like it really was in this case, there's so much of the nuance that you need to make a genuine opinion. Just it's all just completely lost, obviously, because we just don't have that ability to go back in time and see all those kind of facial expressions and the way people carried themselves and things like that. And of course, we get descriptions in the papers, but they're never enough to, you know, you need to experience it to sort of get a proper, genuine opinion. So yeah, like I say, it's almost like flipping a coin. And for me, I guess it's like flipping a coin, but it's heavily weighted on Hall's side. There are some really interesting aspects of the case. Firstly, the South Africa link. You know, why did they even go to South Africa? They went, took them 2 weeks to get there. They stayed 4 days and then 2 weeks to come back. The obvious answer is that they were running away from debtors, and actually they didn't really need to stay in South Africa. They probably didn't want to spend tons of money. They just needed to get on the boat and spend 4 weeks out at sea. So, you know, that was good enough for them. They got there, they didn't need to stay, I guess. That's the obvious answer. And I tend to sort of stick on that as being the reason. But there is an interesting line of theory at the time where plenty of people thought that they were perhaps spies. Now, it has to be said, it's not a theory that I agree with, but there was at the time the Anglo-Boer War going on. And so there's a link there. And I think the fact that he worked in the Royal Armoury, there's a link there that he was kind of maybe potentially a spy. I didn't really look too much into it, and I don't think it's true. I don't think that's the case. I think he generally was just a labourer. But there are questions, you know, like why did he have so much money, and why would he go there, and why would he wear wigs and have a sport a fake name and all the rest of it. And that's kind of interesting. Yeah, the wigs are kind of a step far, aren't they? That's quite strange. But I think when it comes down to it, he was probably just running away from creditors. That he had a lot of debt, and you know, he'd been swindling people, and he was swindled his creditors. And I think he probably came unstuck and just was like, right, we need to clear out for a few weeks. Let's go to South Africa and back. I don't think it's anything more than that. But when it comes down to whether or not he was guilty, that's, I guess, where things get really interesting. And I think the thing is the gold chain never comes across as a particularly convincing piece of evidence. And so the prosecution was essentially saying that the reason it looked like a rope chain, or that Hall said that it looked like a rope chain in the photograph, was because when Mary Jane was breathing, it would have been moving up and down on her neck, and it would have blurred in the photograph, because the exposure would have been relatively long, and it would have blurred. I don't think I believe that. Not only that, It does appear that there is evidence that she had several chains, including a rope chain. Who was she talking to on Friday night when Bennett absolutely categorically could not have been there? So he could have been there on Saturday night, we admit, because he left work on Saturday night. He could have got to Yarmouth and he could have stayed. But Friday night, he definitely couldn't have been, because he was at work on Friday and he was at work on Saturday. And there's no way he could have travelled to Yarmouth and back in the hours that he wasn't at work. So who was she talking to on the Friday night? And so was this someone that she was meeting with all week? Or was it someone that she'd just met that night? So that's suspicious in itself. Then you have the fact that, as Hall stated, he didn't think this was a crime committed by someone who did it premeditated, travelled all the way from London. And I tend to agree with that. I don't think it would have been committed with a bootlace and be so violent. And also, I don't think it would have included sexual assault. Why would Herbert have sexually assaulted his wife and then murdered her? I guess he showed signs of being somewhat violent, and that's true, but I don't. this seems like a big step to have done that. It seems like a crime of sort of passion, or a crime of like a robbery that's gone a little bit wrong, like a sexual assault and robbery that's gone a bit wrong. It seems like that to me. Like, I tend to agree with Hall on that point. And then we have the fact that there really is no motive, because they both were aware that Herbert and Mary Jane were falsely married. And so the marriage was it's technically a sham, or, you know, void. So that once you realise that, there really isn't a motive, unless you can possibly say that maybe she was having an affair and he found out when he was in Yarmouth and then sort of killed her. But there's also evidence that suggests that he already knew that she was having an affair, and it's almost like they sort of separated but not, and there's nothing concrete. And like I say, this is where it comes down to almost flipping a coin. You know, what can convince you the most? You know, whose story convinces you the most? Because I'm sitting here saying all this, and honestly, it's you know, it's Hall, reading Hall's speeches that kind of swayed me. But I could probably sit here and present the complete opposite side and say, you know, well, what, it's a bit suspicious that he travelled all the way to Yarmouth, came back the next morning, started selling off all her stuff. You know, I mean, that, how do you explain that? I mean, Hall explains it by saying that he probably just wanted to get all her stuff gone so that he could hide her existence from Alice, and was just worried that, you know, he was going to be dragged into it, because obviously he would be he would be the prime suspect. And then, of course, on top of all this, you've got the alibi from Douglas Sholter Douglas. That's a funny one. Now, Hall said that he genuinely believed Douglas Sholter Douglas, and that Gill and himself heavily cross-examined him, and he came out saying that he genuinely thought he was completely honest. And when you hear Douglas speak about himself, he obviously backs himself, but he seems genuine. The problem is, I'm not sure he is. Hall said that he thinks that he may have, that everything he said was true, but that he got the wrong date. So he thought that it was on the day of the murder, but actually it wasn't. And I think that's one viable outcome, and I think that's one viable suggestion. But I also wouldn't put it past the man just being a complete fantasist. It was a very common thing. It might be now, I don't know. I don't really know much about sort of modern true crime, but it was certainly a thing in the Victorian period, where you would have these fantasists who would try and sort of elbow their way into a case by being, or you know, concocting a story saying they were witnesses, or et cetera, et cetera. And you also had this very, and you see it in this case, where the suspects would sometimes become, and that they would get an element of sort of fame. And, you know, you'd have people forming crowds just to get a glimpse of him. And you see it in this case, where his defence was paid for by anonymous donations from the public. So you can kind of see Douglas, just maybe wanting his time in the spotlight. I don't know, but I'm not sure I buy it. When you read it, the alibi is, or the testimony just gives Herbert a very convenient alibi, let's say. Like, you know, the fact that he brought up all these things about his life, about him travelling to Ireland and just coming back from South Africa, and that he worked in Woolwich, by the way. I'm not sure. Yeah, I don't know, say flip a coin. But it's an interesting case. It's definitely worth digging into if you find it interesting. There is a lot about the case publicly available. It was mostly called the Yarmouth Mystery, or the Yarmouth Beach Mystery, or the Yarmouth Beach Murder. So if you search those few phrases in an archive, you'll find hundreds of newspapers that followed the case really minutely. You do have to be a little careful. There was a lot of sensationalist garbage. But obviously, when it comes to like the transcripts and stuff, they're more or less verbatim. So that, you know, that there's a lot you can read and find out about the case from just that. And then, of course, also there's Kim Donovan's book, The Mysterious Mrs. Hood. Anyway, all those, if you look at my sources, you'll see all the links to the books that I'd read, at least, about the case. And then some of the newspapers. I don't always include it, all the newspapers I read, because there's hundreds for every episode. But there is a selection there of the main ones with the meat of the trial and stuff. So anyway, thank you very much for listening. If you'd like to contact me about this episode or any other episode or anything really, you can do so. The email is contact@darkhistories.com. You can find links to that on the show notes and on the website, which is darkhistories.com, also on all social media and stuff. If you'd like to support the show, that would be lovely. It's obviously always gratefully received. I'm just a single person making this whole podcast, and it's not particularly cheap sometimes, so any support is greatly received, but you can find out all about that on the website, in the show notes, things like that. So yeah, thank you very much for your time, and thank you very much for listening. I hope you enjoyed the story. Until next time, couple of weeks, take care, sleep tight.